Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. The preliminary Boston mayoral election is less than a month away now, September 14th. Radio Boston will join WCVB, the Boston Globe, and the McCormick Graduate School of Policy and Global Studies at UMass Boston to bring you a debate among the major candidates on Thursday, September 9th. But ahead of the debate, we are inviting each candidate to our virtual studio to make their case to you. And joining us today, Boston City Councilor Andrea Campbell, representing the city's 4th District. Councilor, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you, and thank you for having me.
So, Councilor, I'm going to start off with a question that I'm trying to ask everyone in these conversations. Whoever wins the race will be a first. So why should that first be you? And why are you the right person to lead the city at this moment?
Well, I never jumped into this race to become the first woman or first Black mayor. For me, it was always about the moment in time we were in this city and truly doing the work to address the inequities that we see in the city of Boston while investing in all the things that make us great so we'll continue to be a world-class city. So I jumped into the race back in September and obviously forging ahead, but stressing a few things. One, my lived experience, the very issues that we're talking about, housing affordability, the inequities in our educational system, the public health crises that we are dealing with, not only with respect to COVID, but also the mass and caste crisis. I have lived many of these, and I have talked about the fact that this city gave me everything. Growing up poor in the city of Boston, it took a poor girl out of Roxbury and sent me off to Princeton University. But on the flip side, my twin brother died while in the custody of a state prison. And I've been stressing that this city clearly did not work for him. But the other thing that is distinct about my candidacy is my record of accomplishment. I've done the work of closing the gaps, not only with respect to housing issues in the city of Boston. I've led the way on policing reform. I've put out reports over the years to close the inequities in our education system long before I was a candidate for mayor, which is very distinct than every candidate in this race. And will continue, of course, to do the work, bringing a lived experience, but also a substantial record of accomplishment.
Let's go back to your late twin brother, Andre, for a minute. We have talked with you before about him. You noted that he died while in state custody. He had scleroderma. He was 29. You've said that it partially inspired you to run for office. What is the accomplishment that you would need to achieve as mayor of Boston to feel that you had done justice to Andre's legacy?
Well, the one question I asked when I first ran for city council is the same question in this mayor's race, which is how do two twins born and raised in the city of Boston have such different life outcomes? And what I've recognized is that the city gave me everything to achieve my dreams and to become a candidate for mayor. I had access to excellent education. I went to 5 Boston public schools. All 5 were excellent. I lived in affordable housing and had access to good housing growing up in the city of Boston. I'm now a first-time homeowner in Mattapan. So clearly this city gave me access to mobility and economic mobility. At the same time, I had access to good programming as a young person coming up in the city. So there's a whole ecosystem of opportunity that this city gave me. And so if I am successful, it really is ensuring that every resident in the city of Boston, whether they're native born or they got here this morning, has access to that same opportunity in this city. And ensuring, of course, that we continue to invest in the things that make us great in order to continue to afford great opportunity in the city of Boston to everyone.
So that's a big systems level set of issues. What's the first or most important thing to tackle to get there, to open that pipeline of opportunity that you had to everybody?
There are a whole host of ways to tackle it, but I'm also not naive. We are in a crisis right now. We're dealing with several, I should say. One, of course, is COVID-19. And I continue to exercise leadership on our response there, pushing for the city of Boston, not only to mandate vaccination with, of course, some limited exceptions, but also incentivizing folks to get vaccinated, essentially what we're doing, what they're doing in New York City. We have yet to adopt that here. That is critically important. I live in Mattapan now where we have a low vaccination rate, and I want Boston to continue to lead the way when it comes to our COVID response. So more work to do there. The second is the opioid crisis at Mass and Cass. I refuse to believe that residents that are dealing with the crises as we're seeing there only get worse in the city of Boston, that they have to wait for the next mayoral election to get action from the acting mayor and the administration on those critical issues. And that isn't just about quality of life issues, of course, for those residents. It also is about the folks who are dealing with substance use disorder and homelessness that we have to help. And then lastly, we can close the gap when it comes to housing affordability, our Boston public schools, as well as, of course, economic opportunity generally. And I've put out some very thoughtful plans on how to do that with very specific things, which we'll never cover in 15 minutes, but very specific things that folks can, of course, visit at my website to learn a lot more.
Yes, and we will. We're going to dive into some of those issues that you just listed. I do want to start with COVID. I heard somebody say earlier in the pandemic, it's not just the elephant in the room, it's the room. And right now, it still feels like it is. Earlier this month, Acting Boston Mayor Kim Janey mandated that all city employees be vaccinated. You have said you called for such a mandate. You did it at the end of July. Is this a case of Acting Mayor Kim Janey was too late, or is this a case of better late than never? From your perspective,
she was too late and she's still late. And I want to stress that my pushing back on the acting mayor is about accountability and leadership. It's not personal. And so I continue to exercise the leadership, not only that's distinct from the acting mayor, but from every candidate. I have recognized that this Delta variant is causing severe cases of COVID, an uptick, including in the city of Boston. Our infection rate is going up. And we, of course, want to make sure our vaccination rate is going up. And we want to make sure we're protecting our residents. And so I've exercised leadership for months saying not only should city employees be required to get vaccinated or go through a regular testing, but that we should also push our employers and many others to do the same. And that the city of Boston has to put out guidelines on that. The acting mayor has yet to do that. And I'm also pushing the acting mayor and administration to do what New York City's doing, which is to offer incentives, of course, for folks to get vaccinated and require proof in crowded public indoor spaces, which is critical if we're going to stay ahead of the curve on these issues. And if we don't, we're going to set back our progress. And of course, that hinders our economic prosperity. And I don't want to see that happen in the city of Boston.
You've said it's not personal, the way you have criticized Acting Mayor Janey for how she's handled COVID, but it's been frequent and it's been targeted to the acting mayor. Has she done anything right in her handling of COVID since she took over the office? And if so, what?
It isn't personal. Just as when Marty was the mayor, I always, of course, held him accountable and I would hold anyone accountable. What distinctions I'm trying to make is that my leadership would be different. If I were in that role, I would have already instituted some of the vaccination mandates and mask requiring we're seeing New York City to protect our residents. When it comes to policing reform, I have been a leader on those issues long before I was a candidate for mayor. And then we have right now several cases where the acting mayor has missed significant deadlines and has not responded to public records requests. We just had our attorney general sue us to release records. That's unacceptable. These records would have been released under my leadership. We would have a department that's more transparent and accountable. And the mass and cast situation that is unfolding every single day would not be what it is. I released a plan back in January that has gotten no meaningful response from the administration or acting mayor, continuing to push for implementation of that while recognizing I can only do so much as a city councilor. The power of the mayor's office is significant to change and improve the lives of our residents. And so I'm pushing for those improvements while also holding everyone accountable for delivering what they say they're going to do.
All right, let's stay with mask and cast for a couple of minutes. Then you have an op-ed in the Boston Herald laying out again what you'd like to see done there. A couple of key things are appointing a mask and cast chief, a healthcare professional who would connect people and services. You've called restoring services on Long Island as important, even if that means using ferries. Why those measures?
These are what I heard will work from the stakeholders I engaged when I developed my plan. I engaged members of the previous mayor's task force. I engaged folks who are experiencing substance use disorder, hospitals, community-based health centers, recovery specialists, those who work in supportive housing. I engaged everyone to put forth ideas I knew would have an impact. And what has been extremely frustrating is that I put this plan out in January. I was the first candidate to put out such a plan. And there has been no action, a lot of rhetoric from the acting mayor and administration, but no action. And I stay up late at night getting the calls and the emails from folks who are finding needles in their parks, needles on the ground, and bodies on the street and tents going up in the city of Boston. And I grew up on Mass Ave, and I didn't have any of that growing up poor in this city. And I said, that's unacceptable in the city of Boston. So I'm pushing for implementation of my plan, which I know would have an immediate impact, and hoping that it happens before a mayoral election, because this cannot be political. It really has to be about action to address the other public health crisis that we're dealing with in the city of Boston.
So you also noted just now yourself, needles on the streets, bodies on the ground. You've mentioned feces that on doorsteps in the past. How do you manage the tensions? How does any mayor manage the tensions between providing services to people present in the area and the concerns of residents and businesses in the vicinity who are frustrated by the blight of this opioid crisis?
I think that tension is less so when the city of Boston takes leadership and exercises action, and exercises leadership, I should say, and action. I did several walkthroughs before I designed and drafted my plan. And I engaged businesses, residents, as well as those who were suffering with substance use disorder and homelessness. And what I learned is that everyone wants to do their part to help with that crisis, but they can't do it by themselves. The leadership must come from the mayor's office. We need a plan, we need transparency, and we need accountability. I have all of that in my plan, and I've even pushed for timelines. And if we exercise that leadership, it does not have to be an us versus them. I also talk about the fact that the state needs to step up as well and do its part, which I'm sure it will do with more advocacy, which I'm going to continue. But it doesn't have to be an us versus them. But the city of Boston must exercise leadership. Otherwise, this crisis will get worse quickly.
Okay, shifting gears, because there are a couple of other things I need to make sure we get to in our remaining time. No voting bloc is monolithic. Let's stipulate that. But I know you're also aware of concerns that in past elections, like Boston mayoral race 2013, Black candidates split the Black vote. WBUR politics reporter Anthony Brooks reported today, he's our senior political correspondent, on an effort to coalesce Black Bostonians around a single candidate before the preliminary election. That effort's called Wakanda 2, and they have endorsed acting Boston Mayor Kim Janey. You have come out against that type of organizing. Why?
I haven't come out against that organizing. There are actually many folks who participated in that process who are supporting me in this election. What I have said clearly is that the Black voters of the city of Boston are not a monolith, and that just because you have a Black candidate doesn't mean that Black voters will vote for that candidate. They, like every other voter in the city of Boston, want to know, who are you? What are you about? What have you done? And what will you do? So I'm taking my message not only to Black voters, of course, but to every resident in the city of Boston to say my lived experience is unique. And while it's painful and tragic, it's an opportunity for me to inform the work. And it's also informed the issues I've focused on, including housing affordability, policing reform, and of course, exercising leadership with respect to the public health crises we are dealing with in the city. And I have a long record of accomplishment on significant things, the Office of Police Accountability and Transparency. I drafted that legislation. Of course, putting out a plan to address mass and cast. Housing affordability, the Community Preservation Act was my first piece of legislation. It's generating $20 million every year, including for affordable housing. And the list and record of accomplishment is long and specific. That's the message I'm sharing with voters, along with my plans for the future, which is to make this city not only continue to be world-class, and to invest in our incredible ecosystem here, but to close the persistent gaps in education, our racial wealth gap, and so much more. That's the message that I want voters to respond to. I get out there to do the work to earn their support.
So you joined us on Radio Boston back in May after a Twitter exchange between you and the Boston Police Patrolmen's Association, in which they went after you personally, and you pushed back on them about the Patrick Rose case. You've mentioned police reform several times in this conversation. Your relationship with the union appears quite strained. You have policy positions that involve reducing funding for the police budget, among other things. If elected, will you be able to work effectively with the Boston Police Department?
Absolutely. I already have. And I think what folks don't recognize, I have relationships that run deep in the police department with current police officers, as well as those who have since retired, because the work to transform this department, I've done in partnership with the unions and our officers, along with advocates and residents. My leadership on implementing body cameras. I had to go to court with Commissioner Evans at the time to make that happen. I worked with our police department to get that done. The Office of Police Accountability and Transparency, when pushing for the implementation of this legislation that I crafted in partnership with the previous mayor's task force, I worked with all of the unions and officers and had several working sessions. I've chaired the Committee on Public Safety and Criminal Justice for the council for almost 6 years. And in all of that work, I've gotten to know my captains, my superintendents, district captains, you name it, officers doing the work and working in partnership. That won't change because the only way to actually implement these plans is to actually do it in partnership. And my public safety plan, which is the most specific out of any candidate in this race and truly pushes to transform our response in the city to public safety, to ensure every neighborhood is safe while investing in the root causes of violence, that plan was vetted by officers as well.
So, Counselor, I'm sorry, we have 30 seconds. So, in a sentence, last question to you. School starts September 9th. In a sentence, single most important thing to do to keep kids safe in school.
Mask up and vaccinations must be mandated.
All right, that is Boston City Councilor Andrea Campbell, who represents the city's 4th District. She and the other major candidates for mayor will join us for a debate on Thursday, September 9th. Counselor Campbell, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
The Pfizer-BioNTech COVID-19 vaccine is official. Today, it received full approval from the federal government for people ages 16 and older. It maintains emergency use authorization for youth ages 12 to 15. The FDA announcement puts the two-dose vaccine on par with other marketed vaccines, the first such COVID-19 vaccine to receive this level of approval. So what does that mean for us going forward? Let's turn to Dr. Davidson Hamer, infectious disease physician at Boston Medical Center, a professor of infectious diseases and medicine at Boston University School of Medicine, and a regular contributor with us to Ask the Doctors. Dr. Hamer, welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be back.
So I really want to kind of dig in, Dr. Hamer, to what this means. So Pfizer's been administered widely already in the U.S. under emergency use authorization, more than 200 million doses. What does this change mean, this change in status, and how big of a deal is it?
I think, honestly, it in some ways, it's not that. It's very important because there are a lot of people that want to be reassured that the FDA has gone through a full formal review process. But honestly, and that's really been happening since the beginning, the emergency use authorization, there was a very careful, detailed review of the phase 3 clinical trial data showing how well the vaccine worked and safety. And then since then, we now have literally, I think, at least 200 million doses administered in the United States, and then hundreds of millions more worldwide. So a lot of data have been accumulating on both the safety, but also the effectiveness of the vaccine. So, but this is, a real final official stamp of approval from the FDA. And I think that will be reassuring to some people that felt uncomfortable with the sort of concept of an emergency use authorization.
Yeah. So why, though? What is it about making it from authorized for emergency use to officially approved? What is the threshold? And why should that make, or does it not matter, right? Why should that make people who have been reticent because it was quickly developed and wasn't fully approved by the FDA, why should it make them more comfortable?
I think it means the FDA has gone through a very rigorous review of all available data from immune response to safety to efficacy, and that probably includes data that have accumulated since the EUA was originally issued last December. And I think that knowledge that the FDA has done this really careful scrutiny of the vaccine, may be reassuring to some. In reality, I think many of us have felt very comfortable with it since last year. I mean, the process that Pfizer went through, with NBiotech to have this approved was a standard series of steps that are done to approve a vaccine. It went very quickly, partly because there was an urgent public health need, but in addition, because there was a lot of disease circulating, their ability to show that it worked was accelerated, because it was just, there was just so many cases of COVID-19 happening that it was faster to be able to demonstrate how well it worked.
So I understand that you are a doctor and not a lawyer, and we have done pandemic law on this show in the past, but I do want to ask you to prognosticate a little bit. Now that the Pfizer two-dose vaccine is fully approved for people ages 16 and up by the Food and Drug Administration, do you think we will see more private and public employers moving to vaccine mandates? Will this shift that balance, do you think?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that there are a number of organizations that have been sort of on the edge of making a decision to make this vaccine mandatory for their employees or for students. Some organizations have moved ahead with that decision already, but others have, you know, their sort of internal office of general counsel, their lawyers have said, well, we don't feel like we should really do this until it's fully approved by the FDA. So now that it is, I anticipate we're going to be hearing daily about different large organizations, you know, both state and then private corporations, as well as schools, you know, universities, colleges that haven't already made that decision, will be going towards mandatory vaccination.
Now, you are part of the decision-making team at BU. You work there. WBUR's license is held by Boston University. So you and I are both subject to a vaccine requirement. I take it you are in support of vaccine mandates.
In this context, absolutely. I mean, actually, I mean, you know, even for other diseases, something like, you know, measles, for example, it's you know, we require that for all incoming students at Boston University. Many other universities do as well. I mean, that's a, you know, extremely contagious disease. In this case, we have a similar you know, virus that can be readily spread from person to person. It can cause severe disease and death in at least certain higher risk populations, but also even sometimes in younger healthy people. And this is the best available tool for control of spread, but also to reduce the sort of negative impact it may have on an individual, but also at the level of the public health system. I mean, looking at what's happening in parts of the South right now with, you know, ICUs full and hospitals running out of sufficient nursing staff to care for people. I mean, it's really a public health disaster almost, and this will help mitigate that disaster.
Shifting gears a little bit, have you ever seen a vaccine of this magnitude go from development, which arguably was probably, what, January of 2020, when we know that at least some of the vaccines went under development, to full FDA approval with this kind of speed?
No, I mean, this is you know, definitely like warp speed for this to go that this quickly. But you know, I think it's partly the vaccine development has moved a lot faster in recent years because of improved really scientific capacity. And there are other vaccines that move very quickly from phase one to phase two, say for Zika virus, and all within a period of 6 to 9 months. That didn't go further though, because that epidemic in the Western Hemisphere died down and essentially disappeared. And so, you know, I think that there is no similar precedent to it, but the capacity to rapidly sort of sequence virus, identify it, develop candidate vaccines, test them in animals, move into human testing, and then move quickly through human testing. You know, I think that this will not be the only time that we see a vaccine develop this quickly. And it's good, because in the future, we may be facing more pandemic diseases, and having the capacity to quickly develop a vaccine and use that to control outbreaks is going to be important in the future.
So if we are seeing that kind of speed, what about concerns about just not knowing what the potential long-term side effects are?
You know, generally for vaccines, there are very few long-term side effects. I mean, it's more short-term I would say short-term side effects that are, you know, rare side effects that may be seen when you immunize hundreds of thousands or millions of people that you need to watch for. But most of those are side effects that occur within a few days or at most weeks after receiving a vaccine. It's rare to have long-term sort of late side effects of a vaccine. And I say this from having run a travel clinic and done vaccinology for the last 30 years. I know a lot about a whole range of different vaccines, and I'm less worried about that. I think, you know, having a careful system in place to monitor for unusual adverse events from vaccines, you know, especially early in implementation, is very important. And that's been done with the COVID vaccine.
All right, last question for you. And I guess I'm asking you to prognosticate again. Will this move the needle, no pun intended, among the vaccine hesitant? Will we see more people get vaccinated now that Pfizer's two-dose vaccine is fully approved by the FDA?
I think this is going to help with a subset of people that have been on the fence about whether to receive the vaccine or not. I mean, there's some people that just have very strong beliefs and unfortunately have been subject perhaps to incorrect information that may be less likely to be have their minds changed. But there's clearly evidence. In fact, there's a national survey done that suggested that, you know, a certain proportion of people that were sort of uncertain about whether to have the vaccine would feel more comfortable if it has a full FDA approval. So my hope is that this is going to help sort of tip those people over, and maybe as more of those people do, others will follow.
All right. That is Dr. Davidson Hamer, infectious diseases physician at Boston Medical Center and a professor of infectious diseases and medicine at the Boston University School of Medicine. Dr. Hamer, I appreciate it. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Now, it may send you either running to hide or dancing for joy when I say this, but back to school is pretty much upon us. Wayland starts next week, September 1st. Boston, the magic date is the 9th of September. That is not far away, and that means in-person learning in the time of Delta without a vaccine for kids under age 12. And that means some families are really anxious, parents and kids. Imagine all the uncertainty of a new school year. Will I make new friends? Will my teacher be kind? Will my crush notice me? And will I catch COVID being around other kids again? How do I wear a mask all day? Last week on Ask the Doctors, one local mom called in wanting some advice on how to help her kids navigate that anxiety. We know she's not the only one. So let's talk about it. Let's do a whole segment on it now. In just a couple of minutes, we're going to have two mental health professionals join us to take your questions about how to support your kids' mental and emotional well-being as we start this third school year where COVID is a factor. 800-423-8255 is the number. That's 1-800-423-TALK, or tweet us at Radio Boston. But we did just want to start by warming us up and ask that local mom who called last week to join us for a minute. With us now, Melissa Adler, a mother of two young kids in Sudbury, Massachusetts. Melissa, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Oh, it's great to have you. What spurred you to call? And now, I was on vacation last week. I didn't get to talk to you. Host Jamie Bologna did. But what spurred you to call and to ask the doctors last week?
Because I had made the decision for my children to be fully remote students. I thought that they would be most comfortable. It would lessen the transitions of a hybrid system. And I was also concerned because they both have asthma. And I thought that being home and not having to wear a mask and not having to worry about the social interactions or less than being the guidelines that the school presented, it would be better for them to be here. And now anticipating a new school year, they really were not adjusted that well. And so they've had some concerns.
Most like what? What have they said to you?
Well, you know, they've never really been comfortable wearing a mask. They have been a little bit reluctant about their friends. They did feel that they lost some social connections. It was very isolating for all of us, and I'm a single mom, so they did have each other, but there was a lot that changed, and it was very challenging. Fortunately, I've always raised my children to always talk about things, like very open, very honest, and very direct, and that was something that I didn't have. So I grew up with a lot of anxieties, and I really didn't want them to have that, you know, the same experiences. So we
and
just
Melissa,
talked
how,
about, yeah.
I'm sorry. Go. So let me pick up that thread for a minute, because you're open with them. They're talking. You've raised them that way. I want to key in. I was an anxious kid. I have kids. I want to key in. How are you getting yourself prepared and managing your own anxiety around this?
Well, I'm doing my best to really have faith and to be strong to them and to let them know that we've been very practicing like safe guidelines, and we've been very diligent and consistent with how we're approaching COVID. The tough thing about it is that we have seen, you know, many neighbors and know of friends who have kind of let down their guard. And that does concern me because my children, you know, they're 8 and 10. I still don't really know exactly what will or not affect them physically. So that's hard. And of course, they don't want to get sick, and I don't want them to get sick. So we talk about that. The masks that I've purchased are the masks that the doctors recommend, you know, that you wear, and yeah, that you wash your hands, you know, that they make sure that they listen to what the teachers are instructing them to do, keep their distance when they need to. And obviously, if I need to keep them home, I will do that and not hesitate to do so. But it is hard because we have all these parents have different approaches on it.
Yeah. Thank you, Melissa, so much. I'm sorry, I don't mean to sound impatient. I just know we've got callers who want to come in, and we've got some mental health professionals to add. You have set us up so well for this. Thank you for the call last week and joining us now. Melissa Adler of Sudbury, Massachusetts. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
So we are taking your calls on how to deal with the tricky emotions, the anxiety, the worry of back to school in the third year affected by COVID. We have two mental health professionals join us. What questions are on your mind for your kids, for yourself, as we get ready to do this? 1-800-423-8255 is the number to call to join Melissa in asking your questions. 1-800-423-TALK, or you can tweet us at Radio Boston. Let me welcome our guest now. Dr. Michelle Durham is a pediatric and adult psychiatrist and vice chair of education at the Department of Psychiatry at Boston University. And Omar Ruiz, who has joined us before, is a middle school counselor and licensed marriage and family therapist. Dr. Durham, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks so much for having me.
And Omar Ruiz, welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
So, Omar, I'm going to start with you because today you were in a back-to-school orientation for faculty at your school. Tell me what the conversations are around supporting kids' mental health as they return to in-person learning while the Delta variant is out there and we are still in a pandemic.
A lot of the conversations with staff was trying to reassure everyone that we have already done this before. I know back in April and May, when there was a reintroduction of students to be able to come back or to choose to come back physically to school or to just stay within remote, that was almost like a test drive for students and staff alike to be able to see what would it be like and what are the measurements that we would have to put in place and procedures and policies, as well as COVID testing. So that way we can ensure both students and their families that the school in of itself is able to provide a safe environment for them to return back, as well as for myself and the other counselors within the school building to be able to prep for any potential anxieties or worries that may show up for students and their families.
Are people afraid, Omar?
I would say they're more so not necessarily afraid for COVID, but more so nervous around what a full transition would look like, because we are anticipating that there are going to be some students who might struggle with a big learning curve from having done so well remotely, but having to come back and deal with the social aspect of school.
Just like we were just hearing from parent Melissa a minute ago about her own kids. 1-800-423-8255 to share your worries or concerns. What are you anxious about? What are you hearing from your kids? What questions do you have about how to support your kids as they return to in-person learning this fall? Dr. Durham, what are you hearing from families and kids?
I think echoing a lot of what the parent earlier said, I think, you know, everyone's concerned and worried and everyone wants to be safe and no one wants to get sick. But the message is always for parents, no matter what the problem or the situation is that I think it's important for parents to model the behavior they want in their kids. And you know, sort of putting your own life jacket on first, if you will. So if you're anxious and concerned or feeling down, I think taking care of yourself as the parent or caregiver is super important in order for your kids to feel safe and for their kids' own well-being. And so modeling that behavior that you want in your kids can really go a long way, not only when we think about this situation, but for many situations in parenting. I think listening, you know, and having empathy for all the worries and fears is extremely important. And last but not least, we talk a lot about just sometimes you won't know all the answers. I think kids always come up with really great questions and we don't always have all the answers, and stating that. And that we'll figure it out. You know, the adults, whether at the teachers at school, the counselors at school, the parents at home, that we'll find out the best way to keep us all safe. But sticking with the facts is just such a critical part of all of this too, to reduce anxiety and fear, and to also that we all, you know, don't have the answers all the time, but we'll find them, and we'll make sure that we want to keep everybody safe.
Let's start going to calls. And again, the number to ask your questions and join this conversation, 1-800-423-8255. We've got Joel on the line in West Newbury. Joel, go ahead.
Hi, my granddaughters live in Jamaica Plain, 10 and 7. The school is saying that the kids will be eating in the cafeteria. It's a school of about 1,000 kids, and that you cannot take them out for lunch. So this really concerns me. I don't understand why. That just seems counterintuitive to me.
Thanks for that, Joel. Omar, we heard on Twitter several times today from families who were anxious about the school mealtime. And again, we're taking a social and emotional and mental health perspective here in this conversation, and that should be a time of relaxing and letting down for kids. Mm-hmm. So how to think about that?
I would say first for the parents to, if they haven't already done so, to call and check in with school staff, the principals, about the safety procedures that they are putting into place in terms of if they are in a cafeteria setting, are students being at least put 3 feet to 6 feet apart? Because of course, it wouldn't be expected for students to eat through their mask. They would have to take their mask off. But what procedures are there in place in addition to checking in with the school guidance counselor or adjustment counselor around how available will they be during those first few weeks to be able to check in with students, especially if they're students who have high levels of anxiety or worry or nervousness? So that way, do they need to check in? Do they have to bring that student in to maybe eat in their office in the event that they might struggle with a potential panic attack?
Thank you for that. 1-800-423-8255. To ask your questions, we've got Angela on the line in Holliston. Hi, Angela. Go ahead.
Hi. My son is 6 years old and starting first grade in person this year. He did kindergarten by Zoom. So he's entering school for the first time, really. And this is anxiety provoking on itself, on its own. He also
yes.
struggles with ADHD. He struggles with ADHD, and he actually kind of did well during Zoom, which was surprising to me. So I guess I'm interested to hear what perspectives your guests have about supporting children who are entering school for the first time and also entering going to school with some of, you know, hyperactivity in a time when you can't be hyperactive with your body. You can't, you know, jump into other people's faces, and that's harder for him to manage. So I'm interested to hear on both of those.
Well, and Angela, I remember that first day of school under less extreme circumstances. And, it, you know, I'm thinking about you and your son on the first day of school. Dr. Durham, maybe you can jump in there.
Yeah, I think it's a great question because we have to be obviously practicing distance and wearing the mask. And so, but I do think informing the counselors and teachers and the other adults in the school of what's going on with your kid in particular which we would do in under any circumstance, you know, when a kid is maybe has ADHD or some other mental health issue. We always want to make sure that the teachers and the counselors in the school are informed and can come up with a good plan. There are, you know, there's accommodations and other things that can be done. And so I think notifying the adults and also so that, you know, the kid doesn't get in trouble unnecessarily for something that is real and that is hard for, you know, for him. So I think notifying the school is super important in order for them to best accommodate what may happen on top of already feeling the worries and fears during this COVID time.
1-800-423-8255 to both ask your questions and share your worries or concerns about the social well-being, the mental and emotional well-being of our kids as they go back to school in the third school year that is now affected by the COVID pandemic. Omar, both you and Dr. Durham have now said, talk to the school, right? Call the school and ask a question, call the school and inform them. It can be a little bit inscrutable, especially for a parent maybe who's, it's their first time with a child in a school system. How does one do that? Literally, who do you call? How do you start that conversation? And what do you have a right to expect in terms of responsiveness from the school?
I would say, I can't speak for all schools, but with most schools, my hope is that they are preparing and anticipating to receive calls. So concretely, a parent could call just their main school number, and they could request to either speak with their child's teacher if they're aware who their child's teacher is, or they can speak with the school principal, or they could directly ask for the school counselor, the school adjustment counselor, and just share with them what their concerns are and ask directly of the staff what procedures are in place, what type of support can you provide of my son or daughter. And as far as for the parent, what they can expect is to expect that change can't happen overnight, that with anybody, any student going into school, even when there's adjustment periods, if they're entering middle school for the first time or entering high school or even elementary school for the first time, there's always going to be a sense of anxiety that exists, and that's relatively normal. What we're adding here, which is a sense of complexity, is COVID and concerns around health. And so when you're adding that level of complexity, that adds a little bit more fear towards the anxiety. And that's something that is expected for everyone, especially that this has been a shared experience across the global world. And so for parents, I would say go online, look up your school staff and network, and start learning a little bit more about who are the main key players as far as for your student. Now, there are going to be some schools that are bigger than others, so it might be a bit more complicated, but you're always, your go-to person can always be the counselor that will be assigned to your student's grade level.
We are talking with Omar Ruiz, a middle school counselor and licensed marriage and family therapist, and Michelle Durham, a pediatric and adult psychiatrist. Dr. Durham, we have a call here. Danny is on the line in Andover. Danny, go ahead.
I do.
Hi. Danny, go ahead.
Question. Yeah, thank you. So I'm hearing all this discussion about masks and how we handle the difficulty with children, and I'm drawing a distinction between how the U.S. is approaching it and how Ireland and the U.K. have done it, where the vast majority of their schools are going unmasked based on other research. And I want to kind of get the doctor and the team's perspectives of what a different path that each of these countries is taking.
Sure. Thanks, Danny. And maybe the way to ask it for you, Dr. Durham, because you're focused on social and emotional well-being and mental health, talk about the impacts of mask wearing and how kids respond to that. What do we know?
Yeah, thanks. I think what we do know is that actually most kids have responded quite well. And I think that's when parents have conversations around why we're doing this, what's the purpose, and because we're trying to keep not only ourselves safe, but also all those around us. And, you know, sort of what I had mentioned earlier about when parents sort of model the behavior they want in their kids and how to keep others safe, I think kids automatically will do it because their parents are, you know, well regarded. They respect their parents and want to do the right thing. And so I think having those conversations, being very straightforward about what we know, and what the doctors and scientists and public health researchers have been doing across this whole pandemic is applying rules that can keep all of us safe. And having those conversations with kids, I think, can go a really long way. And especially if we're doing it as the adults in their lives as well.
So I appreciate that. So, and that gives me a chance to pick up the other side of it too. And Omar Ruiz, I'll turn to you on this. Mm-hmm. Are there social well-being benefits of being unmasked? Are there things that are important for us to get to a point where we are sufficiently vaccinated and Delta is sufficiently under control, et cetera, that we can be unmasked in schools? And recognizing that currently, although we are anticipating this will change this week, currently the Commonwealth is allowing local school districts to make those decisions. But are there benefits to being unmasked that are important at some point to get back to as well?
I would say definitely. Outside of just overall health, is being able to just connect with people, being able to see your friends smile and laugh and cheer and yell. Because you can only understand body language so much when you're just focused on one's eyes. But there's a lot of nuances when you're speaking with someone and you can catch different cues through just being able to witness someone's mouth. And there's no level to being able to just feel human again, I think. Having the mask, it is a safety precaution, but it does take away us being able to connect as just human beings and recognizing that every single person has a very unique feature to them. And the one thing that we're missing is just to be able to connect with each other.
With that in mind, Dr. Durham, just last brief question to you. You've talked several times about the importance of modeling behavior for kids. What's a short piece of advice you can give parents to help them manage their own anxiety so that they can model that behavior you're recommending?
I think it's really important to get your own, you know, if you have a mental health need or if you're feeling overwhelmed and maybe it's not reaching the potential where you need to see a mental health professional, but remember to take those breaks, you know, take some time for yourself. I think it's really important. And depending on, you know, the time you have and your work and other responsibilities, even if it's 5 minutes of doing your favorite thing or sitting quietly or drinking that cup of coffee, maybe alone in the morning, I think it's really important to figure out in your day, how are you going to get 5 minutes of time for yourself? Because then you'll be your best self for your kids, your family, and everything else you need to do for that day. And kids, you know, see that, and others in the family will see that. And so if it gets to the point, too, where you're feeling so overwhelmed, where that time for yourself isn't sufficient, then even seeking out that, you know, mental health professional to get more help will benefit, you know, your kid and the family ultimately, as well as yourself.
All right. That is Dr. Michelle P. Durham, a pediatric and adult psychiatrist and vice chair of education at the Department of Psychiatry at Boston University. Thank you.
Thank you.
And Omar Ruiz, a middle school counselor and licensed marriage and family therapist. Omar, thanks for joining us again.
Thank you so much.
And that is our show for today, folks. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.